This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering.
Here and now, I'll just say that I love living in a city where this is not controversial and you got unanimous support from the council and the mayor. It's time for us to end this war on drugs, and this is a good step. Seeing no further discussion, this item is laid on the table for approval.
Mr. President, we move to item number 21.
So you're hearing there the moment that the Somerville City Council unanimously agreed to decriminalize psychedelic plants, becoming the first community in Massachusetts to do so back in January. Cambridge and Northampton passed similar ordinances soon after, and Boston, Worcester, East Hampton are all currently working on their own versions of laws that would decriminalize the possession and use of psychedelics like psilocybin mushrooms. In Massachusetts and across the country, some people are beginning to change their attitudes towards psychedelic drugs, which faced cultural backlash after the 1960s and have been illegal under federal law for half a century. As cities like Somerville move to decriminalize them, it puts pressure on state governments to follow suit. And at the same time, the medical community is shifting in its attitudes, too. Doctors and researchers are beginning to support rigorous studies of how these substances affect the brain and their potential for therapeutic benefit. That's the conversation today, and we will take your calls a little later in the hour. But first, we want to discuss what we know about psychedelics and the brain and dive into the growing field of medical research around their use. So to do that, we are joined by Dr. Jerry Rosenbaum. Just this year, Mass General Hospital launched a new Center for the Neuroscience of Psychedelics. Dr. Rosenbaum directs the center. He's also the hospital's chief of psychiatry emeritus. Dr. Rosenbaum, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, Tiziana. Good to be here.
It's great to have you. So you have very deep knowledge on this. We're taking kind of our first foray as a show and as listeners into this conversation today. So I'm going to start by asking you some fairly basic questions to help us better understand. So first, roughly, how do psychedelic substances affect our brains? What do they do in our brains?
Well, to begin with, there are an array of psychedelic substances that, and they're not all the same in terms of the effects that people experience. But there's a great quote from one of the pioneering psychiatrists in biological psychiatry, a man named Daniel X. Friedman, who was a professor at Yale. And he said that they reveal the capacity of the mind to see more than it can tell, to experience more than it can explicate, to believe in and be impressed with more than it can rationally justify, to experience boundlessness and boundarylessness, events from the banal to the profound. So basically, I mean, these drugs change the brain's processing of the self and the external environment. They create complicated changes in brain function acutely, and can create experiences depending on the set and setting in which they're used that are sometimes described as spiritual or ineffable, mind expanding, dissolving of the self, increasing awareness. All these kinds of terms are applied to the experience of psychedelics. People seek them out for journeys to reach deeper into their knowledge of themselves and to change how they perceive the external world. So they have all these broad effects. They've been used by humans for, you know, thousands and thousands of years and rituals.
Yeah, let's pick that up there. So in the human use, that is really helpful. And maybe for the next couple of questions, I'm going to narrow us to psilocybin, which is the psychoactive component of magic mushrooms, unless there are others that you want to specifically call out. Is psilocybin, for example, being used therapeutically in approved ways now?
So there are no, first of all, these are still Schedule I agents. And so the ability to use them, prescribe them, is really limited. In fact, it's very challenging even to study them. So they're only available for research if you go through a very rigorous process of getting special approvals from the FDA. But they're still scheduled by the DEA as Schedule I drugs that are theoretically have no useful purpose.
So that's really important to underscore. And again, since we're new in this space, so what you're saying is the DEA basically says there basically can't be right now a legitimate use for these substances. Is that what you're telling us?
Yeah, and it's increasingly clear that the DEA is a bit of an outlier. I mean, there have been lots of studies. There's lots of use of these substances in the so-called underground. As you pointed out, there are decriminalization efforts that have gone on both locally and statewide in, say, Oregon, that will make it possible for people to access these substances for various purposes under certain kinds of controls. So they're becoming more widely legitimized. At the same time, they still carry this restriction of being a Schedule I drug.
So why then, and this is going to sound provocative, I don't mean a provocative tone, but why then is there a whole center for the neuroscience of psychedelics at MGH? What are you hoping to research and discover?
There are many millions of dollars that have gone into developing various psychedelics as therapeutic agents. There is a phase 2B trial for psilocybin from Compass Pathways. There's another late stage trial from USANA who have FDA approval to study psilocybin as a treatment for depression and for treatment-resistant depression. So these are being developed as therapeutics. I'd say in 2020 alone, almost three-quarters of $1 billion have been invested in developing various psychedelics for various uses in humans, treating depression, addiction, PTSD, and potentially many other uses. These are powerful drugs that have profound effects on the brain that really going back to the 60s were recognized as potentially treating some of the most burdensome forms of human suffering, from depression to addiction. Among the most important studies were studies that showed that people facing death and dying, getting terminal illness diagnoses when treated with these medicines in controlled settings, lost their fear of dying, and many of them who had then survived for months afterwards still remained relatively at peace with decreased anxiety and depression. So the drugs affect the brain in a way that needs to be understood. There's lots of activity out there, maybe hundreds of new companies exploring how to take advantage of this, what seems almost like a land rush of activity trying to get into the development of potentially approvable drugs. Our center really is not about that, but recognizing that there are profound effects on the brain, we want to try to understand what is happening in the brain, what is changing, is it a good thing, is it durable, is it safe, can we understand it in a way that allows us to exploit that understanding to enhance their value, their safety, to develop new treatments. So we're focused on the science, that the neuroscience of these substances, and less part of the frenzied development of new drugs to bring to market.
What are the risks that we need to understand, especially the risks of potentially using a psychedelic substance outside of medical care?
So these are relatively safe drugs, which I think might be surprising. And they don't cause addiction. If you use them excessively repeatedly, they basically stop working. Your brain stops responding to them. They're really not abusable in the sense that we think of addictive drugs. So as Professor David Nutt in England has described them, they're, with respect to harm to self or harm to others, they're way down the list of many drugs and substances that we allow ready access to or that doctors can prescribe. Their risk is that they create a very intense, profound emotional experience. And if that's done in a very controlled setting, in a safe setting, in a non-threatening setting, often with guides or therapists who are experienced with this to help you through it, For people without psychiatric disorders, it's often described as a very profound, sometimes life-changing experience. And for those with psychiatric disorders like treatment-resistant depression or PTSD, they seem to do something that we've not seen with psychiatric treatments, which is with one or two in the recent MDMA study just published in Nature Medicine, three sessions, you get a change that, you know, takes us weeks with daily prescribing or daily treatments. And moreover, these changes seem durable. So these have profound therapeutic potential if we can understand how best to apply them.
So you just mentioned MDMA. The New York Times reports that many in the field believe that the Food and Drug Administration will grant approval for MDMA to be used therapeutically as soon as 2023, followed by psilocybin a year or two later. Does that time frame sound likely to you?
Yeah, I think it's likely that these drugs will have the evidence sufficient to be approvable. When you talk about harm, the one concern that everybody in this area has is that with unregulated use, with uneducated use, there may be people who have profound negative experiences. They're powerful emotional experiences, and there's some groups of people that we don't even allow into our studies yet because we worry that it can be harmful. People with psychotic disorders, for example. MDMA is interesting. It's different than psilocybin. Psilocybin is sometimes called an entheogen. And, you know, it more has a more spiritual or self-dissolving kind of experience, whereas MDMA is sometimes called an entactogen or an empathogen, which is a substance that creates a sense of warmth and connection to yourself and others. And so it's particularly suited to conditions like PTSD, where you're profoundly damaged by experience that you've had that has changed how you feel about yourself and others. So with MDMA, we're not sure, you know, how many times you can use it safely over time, but the FDA, I think, allows people to have had up to 12 sessions lifetime to be before they could be eligible for studies.
So our last question for you, Dr. Rosenbaum. You've laid out some important questions. You've laid out what the risks and benefits are. Is there anything else we need to understand about controversy or attitudes in the medical community around this emergence of psychedelic substances in treatment?
I mean, the world seems a little bit divided into a group of very passionate believers and advocates, companies pursuing indications for these substances, and many who are just not really aware of the history of, you know, why it became a Schedule I drug, and the this land rush of activity in developing new therapeutic uses for psychedelics. So it really is a need for people to become aware of it, because this is going to be upon us. I mean, yes, it'll be a couple of years before we have any, but given the activity in this space, psychedelics are going to be a big part of our lives and of behavioral health therapeutics in years to come.
That is Dr. Jerry Rosenbaum, the director of the Center for the Neuroscience of Psychedelics at Massachusetts General Hospital. That was very helpful. Thank you, Dr. Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Tiziana.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we are talking about psychedelics today and the shift in both public and medical attitudes towards them. We discussed medical research earlier. Now we are going to turn to the political movement to decriminalize and ultimately legalize them. We have two activists who are deeply involved in this work here to discuss it. James Davis is the lead organizer of Bay Staters for Natural Medicine, a grassroots organization pushing for the decriminalization of psychedelics. And Jennifer Stell is a registered nurse and a co-founder of Bay Staters for Natural Medicine. Jennifer, James, welcome.
Thank you.
Hi, good afternoon, and thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you both. And listeners, we want you to join this conversation. Have you had discussions in your community about decriminalizing psychedelics like psilocybin mushrooms? Have you used psychedelics and had either a positive or a negative experience? Is it something you support? Are you worried about safety, public safety? You can call us 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK or you can send us a tweet at Radio Boston. James, I'm going to start with you. I understand your group played a major role in crafting the decriminalization ordinances in Somerville, Cambridge, Northampton. What exactly does decriminalization mean?
Thank you so much. The decriminalization movement here in Massachusetts accomplishes two central goals at the municipal level. The first is it makes it possible for people to cultivate, use, and have ceremonies with psychedelic plants without worrying about investigation or arrest by law enforcement. The second goal that it accomplishes is decriminalizing possession of all controlled substances and instead prioritizing public health responses, measures, and referrals for our neighbors that are caught with possession.
So cultivation and possession are the two areas of focus when you're doing this at a municipal level. Is that right?
That's right, because for our volunteers and our people, the entire war on drugs has substantially harmed our communities and our members. For example, at age 5, my family was forced to evacuate a trailer park where I grew up after a meth lab exploded in a fire just a couple doors down. To this day, drug dealers run my neighborhood and terrorize my mother. Cops followed me in and out of the trailer park to church and Boy Scouts, but cops also intervened to stop horrific domestic violence in my neighborhood too. Our position is that illegal methamphetamine and all of these drugs have waged war on our families and communities with cousins I consider brothers so addicted to dope that they rob their own families. They live in a cycle of homelessness, jail, rehab, overdose, and risking custody of their children. Arrests strip people of jobs.
So James, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you there. I want to say two things. One, thank you for sharing where your personal story comes in on this. And two, I just want to make clear for our listeners, because Dr. Rosenbaum talked to us before the break about the fact that psychedelics are not addictive in the way that some of the other substances that you're talking about are. But I think what you're saying is, for you, this is part of the larger effort to end the drug war using a decriminalization approach. Would that be fair to say, James?
Absolutely. And our position is that all drugs are basically already legal just for certain people and certain corporations to sell them to us. So take, for example, methamphetamine that has terrorized my family. At schools like BU and Northeastern, your kids are so stressed about their futures that they down Adderall, a light version of meth, like it's candy. Big Pharma has worked with consulting companies like McKinsey to get people so addicted to SSRIs, Xanax, and opioids that people can barely tell up from down. So our position is that psychedelic plants, psilocybin mushrooms, ayahuasca, and ibogaine, are the solution to a lot of addictions that have been the result of Big Pharma. And okay, we're not going to rest or leave people behind in our move to end these arrests and investigations.
Okay, so let's pick it up from there. What I'm going to do, so we've got some calls coming in, but we haven't heard from Jen yet. So Jen, I'm going to turn to you for a minute before I go to the phones, because so Jeff just introduced a new idea, which is the sort of replacement usage and alternatives. And you are a nurse, but I also understand that psychedelics have played a major role in pain treatment in your life. So tell us about your experience with use of psychedelics. I think I might have said Jeff, by the way. I meant James. I apologize for that, James. Jen, tell us about your use of psychedelics in your own pain treatment.
Sure. So to start, my story starts when I was 8 years old. I was diagnosed with chronic cluster headaches, which is one of the most painful chronic afflictions known in the medical community. When I was 12, I was also diagnosed with chronic migraines. I spent a lot of my childhood visiting doctors, being tested on, giving mind-numbing medications, and enduring relatively painful procedures in an effort to gain control over my pain. In my early teens, I started using cannabis, both recreationally and medically. But then when I was around 16, I was introduced to heroin by someone who I believe thought they were helping me during one of my severe attacks. I ended up going to several rehabs in my teens and was able to get off the heroin, but I continued to use cannabis. When I was 17, I was arrested for cannabis possession. I was charged, tried, I was convicted, and given a 5 to 10 year sentence for 2 ounces of cannabis but was then given an option to go to rehab, this like rehab type place in New York for 2.5 years instead, with my sentence suspended and contingent on my successfully completing the program. It was there I both witnessed and endured a lot of abuse. When I came home, I was broken, paranoid, depressed, and still suffering from pain on a daily basis. I continued to go to doctors looking for help who prescribed numerous medications and treatments. But when all avenues were exhausted, I was prescribed opioids. And I did well with that for a while. I took them as prescribed, but I continued to suffer with pain, and my depression and anxiety continued to increase, and I started to abuse them. Then my biggest support and the closest person in my life, my mom, died, and I completely fell apart, and I ended up relapsing on heroin. I went to 2 rehabs and relapsed and felt like I was completely hopeless. It was then that I tried to commit suicide, and I'm now thankful that I failed. It was at that point I was told by a friend of the family about Ibogaine and a woman in the States who was providing treatments and asked if I would like to participate in that kind of treatment. And I was all on board. So I took my life savings and I went to her and began my journey of healing. Ibogaine is a substance that comes from the root bark from the iboga tree in Africa. And it helps addicts because it resets the brain to a pre-addicted state. And it gives a person a huge jump start in recovery by getting rid of cravings, withdrawals, and starts the mental healing by exposing the forces that drives the person to use. This woman who I received the Ibogaine from told me about using psilocybin for my cluster headaches and migraines and encouraged me to use them when I got home. So when I got home, I obtained some mushrooms, and for the first time in my life, I went 6 months without a headache. I also noticed that my anxiety
so Jenna,
and my depression...
go ahead. So tell us about that. And again, I don't mean to be disrespectful by interrupting you. I want to get some caller voices in here, and I want to ask some other questions too. So let me just ask your anxiety and depression. Did you find that the psychedelics helped with that as well?
Dramatically. So overcoming addiction was huge, but getting over and gaining control over my cluster headaches and migraines was life changing. I now continue to use psilocybin for management of my headaches and migraines. I also, now that I've come to understand this fungus better, I incorporate them both for my mental and spiritual healing in my sessions as well. So I wish I could explain how pivotal like using psychedelics has been for me. And I really just want to share it with everybody, which is one of the reasons why I was all on board on starting this group and this movement.
So I'm going to pause you there. Thanks to both of you for telling us your stories and why you're coming to this. We've got some callers who'd like to add their voices. I'm going to pick up a few of those now at 800-423-8255. We've got a caller going by Adam on the line from Brookline. Adam, go ahead.
Hello. Thank you so much for taking my call. And Jen, also thank you for sharing your story. Both of you, I appreciate your activism. I'm going to talk briefly about my experience with psilocybin, just in terms of kind of the underground usage of it. Like Jen, I have kind of a I don't know how rare yours is, Jen, but I kind of have a freak condition where I was growing around a pinched nerve in my neck for most of my life is the hypothesis. And I only realized this recently, but I've been dealing with chronic nerve pain and neurological disorder, you know, all the, you know, mental issues that come with having chronic pain. And really, while I have found some help in the hospital systems here in the area from doctors with nerve pain medications such as Cymbalta, the best treatment for me has been psilocybin by far.
And Adam, how long have you been using psilocybin? No, how long have you been using it?
Medically, I would say over a year. Go ahead.
And have you experienced any negative side effects? Do you have any concerns about long-term side effects from the psilocybin, Adam?
I try to do my research. I know there, if you use it too much, there can be problems with vision, but I will have some, you know, kind of standard doses that people would call like a trip, but also I'd say more often it's micro smaller doses in the form of teas kind of at every other day. I try to read some, you know, the scientific studies that are available. Obviously, the issue is that not tons of information is available, but I do talk to, I have talked to some doctors that I work with kind of off the record about this. So it's not totally, you know, it's not a surprise to some people who are seeing me, but it's still completely experimental. And this is something that I would love to be studied more because of how beneficial it has been for me, both physically and mentally.
Adam, thanks for that call. I appreciate it. So I want to turn back to you now, James. The scenario that Adam's talking about, of course, that's all in the context of at the federal level, this being a Schedule I drug, as Dr. Rosenbaum told us in the first part of the show today, and with decriminalization only having happened in some communities. Is there a sense that with decriminalization, there could also be better medically supervised interactions with psychedelics? And what would the landscape be around making sure that these substances were pure and safe as well?
It's a phenomenal question. I'll start by saying that Adam and Jen are not alone. There are thousands of people we have met across the Commonwealth that have found relief from these plants. As you mentioned, because it will take nearly 3 years for the FDA to approve medical access to these plants, we don't have time to waste. Our neighbors are committing suicide. Our neighbors are passing away of overdoses. People are in extreme pain and suffering in the aftermath of this pandemic. And if we do not decriminalize, meaning that we ask law enforcement to just let people be, companies like Compass Pathways and Atai Sciences might enter the space in 2 to 3 years, charging nearly $10,000 for a psilocybin therapy treatment that costs only about $30 for people to purchase and use with their friends or therapists.
So I don't have a way to fact check that part of it real time, James, but I understand what you're talking about in terms of accessibility. I'm also just going to take a second here because you and Jen both thoughtfully, Jen in your own experience and James in your concern for others, have raised the possibility of somebody who's contemplating suicide. And for whom that might resonate, I just want to put out that the Suicide Prevention Lifeline number is 1-800-273-8255. That's 1-800-273-TALK. Let's go back to the phones here. Let's pick up Kathy, who's calling from Cambridge. Kathy, go ahead.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, and thanks for everyone for sharing your experiences. My question is really around the regulation of if psilocybin and other psychedelics were to become legal, how would we regulate that? I've had very positive experiences. I have friends who've had very negative experiences, and I feel like it could be dangerous if it is available to anyone anytime.
Kathy, thank you for that. So, Jen, as part of this conversation on decriminalization and potentially, I understand the agenda includes legalization, are you proactive in pursuing a regulatory relationship or thinking about regulation? How do you think about that as an advocate?
As an advocate, there probably should be some kind of regulation down the road, but currently a lot of those regulations would probably exclude certain indigenous groups that actually use these psychedelics to promote their own spiritual wellness. And regulating it will also most likely make it inaccessible to people the way it has cannabis. Cannabis is very regulated. However, it's extremely expensive, and many people with low income are not able to go into the dispensaries and purchase it, so they're still receiving it on the black market. So we want it to be transparent and have it something that people can access from growers who are doing it appropriately. So those growers can actually get out there and talk about what they do and provide good products. So I don't know what the answer is to that, honestly.
That's helpful, though. And James, you and Jen now have both brought up issues of equity and access, affordability, et cetera. I guess I want to ask you, in your mind, what's the end game? What would your goal be for availability, legalization, et cetera, of psychedelic substances in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts?
The end game is a community-based infrastructure where people can grow their own, exchange it with their neighbors, and use it in ceremonies with their church groups, with nonprofits, and with any center that wants to offer it in a supervised setting. Right now, our first responders are suffering 5 times the rate of PTSD as the ordinary population. Folks are reeling from violence and from mental health issues. We don't have time to wait, and the vision is to make these plant medicines destigmatized and as accessible as possible as soon as possible. What I'll say of a regulatory framework, companies have a lot of power. There's $750 million at stake for MAPS. My source is the New York Times. There's a lot of money at stake in this in terms of the pharmaceutical companies. So we need to ensure first and foremost that our cities are not going to arrest people for drug possession and instead focus on harm reduction and safety.
And Jen, what is your parting message to people who are listening today? You know, we've talked about stigma and concern. We've talked about side effects. We've talked about access and opportunity. We've talked about the potential of psychedelics. You've talked about your personal experience with them. Your parting thought?
My parting thought would be that I just want people out there who are suffering either with PTSD, anxiety, depression, addiction, or chronic pain to know that there is good, effective treatment out there and that it is our goal to make it accessible and available to people who are suffering. And because it is stigmatized, not a lot of people, even if it does become available on the mainstream market, might want to come out and say they use it because it might be frowned upon either in their profession or with their family members. So we would like people to know that, you know, getting access to these is crucial right now. Getting cities and our elected officials to decriminalize has to happen now. We're really out there to help a lot of people who are suffering and educate those who are uneducated about why this movement is so important for so many people.
All right. Jennifer Stella is a registered nurse and co-founder of Bay Staters for Natural Medicine. Also with us, James Davis, who's the lead organizer of Bay Staters for Natural Medicine, which is a grassroots organization pushing for decriminalization of psychedelics. Thanks to both of you.